Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 21st, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, new images of Mars prompt scientists to reconsider the history of water there. Why geneticists are looking to the dog in addition to the worm, fruit fly, and mouse, and revisiting the mysteries of Easter Island. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has been sending back enormous amounts of data and images, especially with its high-resolution imaging science experiment, known as HiRISE. The HiRISE researchers have been blogging and writing about it, and now, in several papers in this week's special issue of Science, Alfred McEwen and colleagues report that their images complicate the history of water on the Red Planet. I spoke with McEwen from his office at Arizona State University.
With HiRISE, we can image the surface at higher resolution, higher signal to noise, and get a closer look at many of the features that have been described previously as evidence for water on Mars.
Now, what kind of resolution are you getting?
The pixel scale varies from about 25 to 31 centimeters per pixel, which is about a factor of five better than the Mars Orbital Camera on MGS. And so then resolution really depends on what you're looking at and the signal to noise and the contrast. But I like to think of it as typically about 3 pixels is the size of object you can resolve. So we can resolve roughly meter scale objects.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you are learning now with these new measurements?
We focused on 3 different areas. One is the northern plains, which some had suggested has been the site of an ancient ocean that, according to one hypothesis, was covered by a thick mantle of fine-grained material that settled out from this ocean. What we see are boulders everywhere. So unless there's been a surprising amount of other geologic activity that brings up boulders somehow, it's difficult to reconcile with that particular model for an ocean. There are others, such as from giant floods and debris currents and so forth.
And these boulders you're seeing because of the increased resolution?
That's right, yeah. And we did a lot of imaging up there, in particular finding a landing site for the Phoenix lander, where they had a landing site, and our images showed too many boulders for it to be a safe landing site. And so we searched around and found a better spot for them. But we also imaged lots of other areas up in this lowest part of the northern hemisphere, which is where the ocean would have settled down and deposited any material. And it's boulder-rich everywhere. So that has to be factored into any explanation for the history of this area and what's covering it. So
what else did you look at?
We also looked at materials in that filling craters. There's this mid-latitude debris mantle, and in some places it covers the slopes of craters, and sometimes these are associated with gullies. So one hypothesis was that this was a snow deposit, basically, from a different climate, recent climate, which melted to form gullies.
This is the tree-like gullies on the side of a mountain you might see here on Earth, or something else?
Yeah, branching gullies on steep slopes.
Okay.
And there's different models and hypotheses for the origin of these gullies. There's some debate about whether they're carved by water, whether they're dry, whether they're fluidized in some other manner. And there's also debates about most people believe that water has been involved in at least some of them, but then the debate is where did the water come from? And it could be groundwater, or it could be melting of snow that fell in a different climate, or it could be melting of near-surface ground ice. So one hypothesis was that not only was it snow, but the snowpack was still there in these deposits that we were seeing in lower-res images.
And what do you see now?
From high-rise, we've looked at those deposits, and it's full of boulders, so that's not snowfall.
So boulders seem to be a common element going through these.
Yeah, we see boulders very well with high-rise, and there's a lot of them, especially in certain areas in these higher latitudes. The gullies themselves, in some cases, really look very strongly like they were carved by water to us. There's braided channels, there's terraces, there's features that would be without doubt interpreted as watery flows on Earth. It's just that they didn't necessarily occur. They occurred geologically recently, but not necessarily in the current climate. So it doesn't address the question of whether the water is possible in the current climate. So it's a matter of refining when and where water flowed on the surface of Mars.
So we've got two areas where there are boulders and
we've got two areas where attempts to confirm water-rich interpretations haven't really been confirmed by what we've seen. Now, the third area is in the ejecta of young impact craters. And here, the story is very different. And what we're seeing are what look like fluvially water-carved modified landscapes. There's channels, there are alluvial fans, there are debris flow-like features. So we are surprised to see all this in young craters. There's lots of this type of landforms, even larger in scale, from the very ancient terrains. And there's been a lot of debate about this, the Noachian evolution of the landscape. Noachian is the early geologic period of Mars history. And did it rain? And was it a climate change that was a long-term stable climate change? Or was it an episodic climate change, perhaps related to impact events?
And with high rise?
What we're seeing now in these recent impact craters supports the latter idea that much of this ancient landscape modification, back when the impact rate was much greater, there were many more large impact craters, so it would have had a much greater effect. Maybe that can explain much of what we see in Noachian.
So this third one then is you're seeing water patterns, or what look to be like the same sorts of water patterns in these late or very recent impact craters. And that could have been caused by the material that was ejected when whatever it was that was slamming into the Martian surface hit?
Right. Exactly how this happens is still not completely clear.
Well, it sounds like this is the kind of science where, you know, you find something out and get a better observation, and it ends up bringing up more questions than it answered.
That's right. It's a process, and it's not often that we have a definitive answer, and that's the end of the debate. The debates go on, but we get closer along the way. It's fun.
That's good to hear. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Alfred McEwen is lead author of a paper that takes a closer look at water-related geologic activity on Mars. Read more about the planet's water, ice, and geologic activity. It's the initial results from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft in the September 21st issue of Science. Also this week in Science, sequencing a parasite. Elephantiasis is a debilitating infection that threatens millions of people in the tropics. Now, Elodie Geddon and colleagues have sequenced the genome of B. malai, the parasitic worm that causes the disease. With the genome, scientists can compare it to the non-parasitic worm, C. elegans, and figure out what genes cause the parasitism, with the eventual goal of curbing the disease. Read the paper in the September 21st issue of Science. While geneticists have typically relied on DNA from worms, fruit flies, and mice for their work, more and more of them are looking to the genetic makeup of another model, dogs. Science News writer Liz Panisi has been following this trend and reports on it in this week's issue.
Human geneticists are coming to appreciate the value of the dog and dog genetics in trying to find genes for inherited diseases and for complex diseases.
Do dogs share similar diseases with humans?
Yeah, among the top 10 dog diseases are things like cancers, heart disease, epilepsy. So yeah, a lot of the diseases are the same.
But the similarity in diseases doesn't mean similarity in genes, does it?
It may and it may not mean similarity in genes. There are some genes that will be shared by both. There are some genes that maybe the dog has a problem with a particular gene for a particular cancer that won't necessarily be found in humans, but what that gene does is it clues researchers into a molecular pathway that might include the gene that's in humans. So it will still be helpful to find out the dog gene. It will help you figure out the human gene.
Does it make any difference to a researcher if the dog is a mutt or a pure breed as to whether or not they'll find similar analogs in humans?
For the genetic studies, it's actually pretty important to use a purebred. And the reason is that because they're purebred, there's very good records about who's been mated to who. And you get a gene pool where you have a lot of similarity in the dog's genetics so that when you're looking for a particular problem, it's easy to pick out that mutation that causes the problem, easier than, say, if you were looking at a group of humans, even related humans.
Now, when you say easier, what does that mean? Is it fewer number of samples or what?
Fewer number of samples, so fewer number of dogs are needed in a study. And the way they track down genes is they look for variation across the genome, and you don't need as many of these variable spots in a dog to sort of home in on a gene.
Sounds a little bit similar to how researchers were looking at isolated populations of humans like Finland or Iceland.
Right. It is very similar.
Okay. Now, dogs are also bred for behaviors like affection or aggression. Are we going to see some analog in helping humans with something along those lines?
That's initially why people started to want to look at dog genes. In the early 90s, the researcher was very curious about how dogs develop sort of predilection to specific behavior. So you have Newfoundlands who are great swimmers, and you have Border Collies who are great herders. And those, because it's breed specific, those have a genetic component. And so the idea is that you could, by interbreeding these dogs and looking at their differences, you might be able to track down the genetic components of a behavior, which is something would be very, very difficult in humans. And now that they have the dog genome and have these maps of genetic variation and ways to assess genetic variation in dogs, there are several studies that are going on where researchers are trying to find out the genetic basis of, say, there's a disease called cocker rage, which is sort of a form of aggression, sort of unexplained aggression on the part of cocker spaniels and English spaniels against their owners. Another kind of behavior that is not necessarily emotional, but still a behavior is pointing behavior. Why do some dogs breed points? And the researchers are hopeful that they can get at sort of the genes underlying pointing.
And how will this help with some human diseases, or will it?
Well, for example, understanding rage, some genes that might influence rage, could be important because in a lot of mental disorders, you have people who have rage as a symptom. So there could be relevance. In terms of understanding the genetic basis of pointing or the genetic basis of swimming, I think the hope is that if you can understand how you get a complex behavior, sort of what kind of genes are involved, are there a lot of genes, are there a few genes, how does the environment influence that, if you can get a handle on something like that, it'll help you figure out how to get a handle on a complex human behavior.
This seems to raise some serious questions about the sort of nature versus nurture, that this all might be a part of our genetics as to who we become. Are researchers tackling those questions as well as they look into this?
Yes. I mean, I think it's always going to be a little bit of both, nature versus nurture. One of the things that's interesting about dogs is they grow up in the same environments that we do. They're in our homes. They're exposed to the same kind of allergens, environmental pollutants and everything. So there's a chance that you can start teasing out sort of what's the role of nature versus what's the role of nurture in these animals in a way that you can't with humans.
I'd always thought that mice and other rodents were typically used for such genetic research. Is it because the dogs are living with us, and hopefully the mice aren't, that researchers are turning to dogs?
It's a little bit of that. It's a little bit of the fact that these dogs get these diseases naturally. For a lot of mouse models of cancer, for example, you have to expose the mouse to a chemical and induce the tumor, whereas a dog will get older and develop bladder cancer, just like a human will get older and develop bladder cancer. So it's a more similar, more natural situation. With things like behavior, there's a lot of behaviors that dogs show that mice don't.
I bet.
And so there's just some things that you can't study in mice that you don't study in humans, but you could study in dogs.
So dogs are the geneticist's new best friend.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing this story with us.
Well, thank you.
Read Liz Panisi's news article on the insights emerging from dog genetics in the September 21st issue of Science. Also this week in Science, The Hobbit may not have been human after all. By examining three wrist bones from the so-called Hobbit fossils from Flores, Indonesia, Matthew Tocheri and colleagues show that the bones are shaped differently than the wrist bones of both humans and Neanderthals. Instead, these bones represent a more primitive hominin species, whose ancestors branched off before the human-Neanderthal common ancestor. Read, The Primitive Wrist of Homo Floresiensis and Its Implications for Hominin Evolution, in the September 21st issue of Science. Easter Island, with its large statues, lack of trees, and troubled history, has long been a source of mystery. In a perspective in this week's Science, Jared Diamond revisits those mysteries and what scientists are doing to solve them. I spoke with Diamond from Los Angeles, where he is a professor at UCLA. There are lots of hypotheses about what happened on Easter Island, and you've written about it yourself before. Is there something new that prompted you to reconsider what happened there?
There's lots new. These are really great times for everyone interested in Easter Island because there are half a dozen long ongoing major research projects that are producing new results flooding into us. So for people like myself who've been interested in Easter Island for 40 or 50 years, these are great times to be alive.
What is some of that new information?
Well, just as one example of a discovery over the past several years, large fractions of the area of Easter Island, more than half of the area, are just covered with rocks. And in most of these places, these are rocks that evidently were not there originally, but were placed there by people. Incredible quantities, roughly a billion rocks, and the rocks weigh on the average several pounds, so they were placed there. And these are in gardens and fields. Well, usually farmers take rocks away from their fields. Why on earth were Easter Islanders putting rocks into their fields? That's been one of the discoveries of recent years. They began putting rocks into their fields roughly around the year 1300 or 1400. And the rocks, it turns out, have been shown by experiments to serve many functions. The rocks absorb the heat of the sun, so they keep the soil warm. They prevent water from evaporating, which is a big deal on this rather dry island. And then finally, the rocks may be like the slow-time-release vitamin capsules that many of us take at breakfast to release vitamin C for the rest of the day. Well, the rocks release nutrients like phosphate, which are limiting to plant growth, and so the Easter Islanders may have discovered that the rocks are like a hard fertilizer.
Now, this isn't something, as you mentioned, that most farmers would do. What would have prompted such sort of extreme measures in trying to get nutrients back into the soil?
This came at a time of crisis, environmental crisis on Easter Island. In about the 150 years before people stumble on this rock solution, they had chopped down the palm forests on the island, but these palm trees, the biggest palm tree in the world, provided what one calls green fertilizer. That's to say, the leaves and the debris of the palm would have provided organic matter to stimulate crop growth in the soil. But with the palm trees eliminated, there went the green fertilizer. People had to do something else. In addition, the palm trees, the canopies of the palm trees, would have shaded the soil from overheating and from drying out. So people had to find something else, and evidently they stumbled on independently coming across this invention of rock gardens, which are also practiced in the Mediterranean and in the U.S. Southwest. But the Easter Islanders came upon the discovery independently.
It sounds like deforestation then was the main driver, perhaps, of the downfall of Easter Island's population. Or would this stone farming method have been enough to keep the population going?
The stone farming certainly did keep the population going for a couple of centuries. Yes, it is fair to say that deforestation was the biggest damage that the Easter Islanders unintentionally inflicted on the island. And when I say that, I immediately have to add that many people get upset when they hear it said that the Easter Islanders damaged their environment and so got themselves into trouble. There are many people who would react by saying, oh, these nice people never would have made that mistake and they would have been foresighted. Well, the fact is that nice, normal, foresighted people like the Easter Islanders and like ourselves today still can make mistakes when dealing with difficult environmental problems. The other big impact that the Easter Islanders inflicted on themselves was to exterminate most of the seabirds and all of the land birds on the island that would have provided not only food, but again, the seabirds, the guano or the seabirds, would have provided fertilizer.
You mentioned that the Easter Island is, from your perspective, a metaphor for what is going on today. What in particular makes you say that?
Easter Island, it is a society that self-destructed ecologically by unwittingly damaging their environment to the point that human subsistence was impaired. And in the case of Easter, the island is so remote, it's the most remote habitable scrap of land in the world, in the Pacific Ocean, about 2,300 miles west of Chile. When the Easter Islanders got in trouble, there was no place that they could run away to and no place from which they could summon help. By the time they chopped down the forest, they didn't have wood to make big canoes to go flee. So Easter Island was isolated in the Pacific Ocean. But Easter, isolated in the Pacific Ocean, is like the planet Earth isolated in space. If we humans wreck our own planet, and in fact, we, of course, we are in the process of heavily damaging our environment today, there isn't any other galaxy to which we'll be able to flee, and there aren't any green extraterrestrials out there whom we'll be able to summon for help. So that's why Easter Island is viewed as a metaphor for what may be happening to our world today in a worst-case scenario.
At the end of your perspective, you posed your six favorite unsolved questions about Easter Island. If you could choose which mystery gets solved first, which one would that be and why?
I would like to see all six of them solved first because they're all so interesting. Just arbitrarily to pull out one, and it happens to be the one that I mentioned first, the writing of Easter Island, so-called Rongo-Rongo writing. When Europeans started visiting regularly or living on Easter Island in the 1800s, they found that Easter Islanders were writing on wood. It's called Rongo-Rongo writing. The first dated piece observation of Rongo-Rongo writing we have is about in the 1860s, and that was 140 years after Europeans first spotted Easter Island. So there's the question, did Easter Islanders devise writing for themselves before Europeans arrived? If so, that would have been remarkable because writing otherwise evolved in places with huge populations and state governments, China, the Fertile Crescent, Mexico. If Easter Islanders had invented writing, they would have been by far the smallest society in the world to have done it. The alternative is that Easter Islanders developed writing when Spaniards landed on Easter around 1772 and wrote a proclamation so that Easter Islanders would have seen Europeans writing and then would have imitated it. The signs of Easter Island writing, Rongo Rongo, are nothing like our alphabet. In fact, it's not even an alphabetic system. So, big question, did writing develop on Easter Island before 1722 or after 1772? We don't know, and that's one of my six favorite questions.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me today and for sharing your perspective with us.
You are welcome. It's a fascinating story, and I'm happy to talk about it.
Jared Diamond discusses the mysteries of Easter Island and his six favorite questions about what happened there and a perspective in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, is in the studio with Science Magazine's online editor, Stuart Wills, for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
David Grimm, welcome back. What have you got for us today?
Well, Stuart, three cool stories for you, as always. We'll talk about how honeybees suffocate their enemies, the seductive power of male bravado in chimpanzees, and finally, how loneliness causes disease.
How Honeybees Suffocate Their Enemies. Now, that sounds enough like a horror movie that I'd like to jump right into that one.
Right. Fortunately, enemies here we're talking about are hornets and not people, but it's pretty gruesome nonetheless. Researchers knew that honeybees, if they encounter an enemy such as a hornet, which will come by and try to either kill bees or steal food from them, can engage in a process called thermoballing, which sounds a little bit like a James Bond movie, maybe.
That's right.
But basically what it is it's, you know, anywhere from 10 to hundreds of bees will swarm around a hornet and not consume the hornet, but cause so much heat by swarming around the hornet in very close proximity that they will actually toast the hornet to death.
So they gang up and roast the hornet to death.
They roast it to death, right. But that trick doesn't work for hornets that live in warm locales such as Saudi Arabia or Cyprus, because they're already used to warm temperatures.
Right. It's already hot here, guys.
It's already
what can you do to me?
Making it a little hotter isn't going to make a difference. But scientists have observed that honeybees are still able to kill hornets in these locales by swarming around them. So they said, well, if they're not killing them by thermoballing, how are they doing it? And what it turns out is they're doing it by suffocating the hornets. And
well, how does one make that distinction, though?
Well, so it has to do with the way that hornets breathe, and they have a really sort of vulnerable and interesting method of respiration where when they exhale, the plates of their exoskeleton cover these holes in their abdomen called spiracles. And the only way they can open up these holes again to breathe is by contracting their abdomen. But if there's a lot of pressure on them, like hundreds of bees around you, sitting on you basically in this large ball, they're unable to open these holes again and they're unable to breathe. And scientists discovered this by being able to prop open these holes with these little plastic wedges, which actually...
Now that sounds like a great thesis project.
Right. I'm glad I wasn't involved in that one. I don't know how many people got stung during this experiment. But basically what they found is when they wedged these holes open on the hornets, the bees had a much harder time suffocating the hornets, which was evidence that they are in fact killing these hornets by preventing them from breathing.
So bees continue to surprise us even after all this time.
Right.
So let's move on to these macho chimps now.
This story has to do with a group of chimps living in the African village of Basu, if I'm pronouncing that right, Guinea. And what researchers have found with chimpanzees is they'll often, to woo females or to build power or hierarchies, will take maybe meat from a predator, like a colobus monkey. They'll kill the monkeys and they'll share the meat with certain females or males of the group to build power, to advance sexual relationships.
A food for sex program.
A food for sex program, exactly. But in Basu, meat isn't very prevalent. So the chimpanzees have to rely on crops instead. It's a mostly vegetarian society for these chimps. And researchers saw some interesting behavior where these chimps would actually conduct raids on a specific type of crop, namely papaya, which were hard to get, involved a lot of anxiety and the chimps being exposed when they would conduct these raids to get the papaya. And what they found was that the chimps that got these papayas, the more daring the raid to get the papayas, the more impressed the female seemed to be when the chimps brought the papayas back to them.
So showing off might actually get you somewhere.
Showing off seems
to
get you somewhere, at least in this very small chimp community. And it's the first evidence of what researchers are calling male bravado. In other words, that females aren't just excited by the gift that they're getting, but how much trouble the males actually went through to get that gift seems to play an important role in building these relationships with the opposite sex.
And finally, a story about the fact that loneliness may be hazardous to your health.
Right. Well, this isn't just ordinary everyday loneliness. It's something researchers call chronic loneliness. And these are people that feel lonely. Even if they're surrounded by friends and family, they still feel lonely. There's really nothing you can do to pick them up or make them feel like they have a social circle. And researchers have observed for a while that lonely people tend to have more diseases, tend to be more unhealthy than people that aren't lonely, at least chronically lonely people. But they really haven't nailed down exactly what's going on a molecular level. And so what researchers did is they recruited about 150 people in their 50s and 60s and subjected them to what's called the UCLA Loneliness Scale, which was developed by scientists at the University of California, Los Angeles. And the subjects had to answer questions like, how they rated in questions like, I feel like I'm alone in the world, or there's no one I can count on. And when the researchers gave this test, this to this group of people, and then they picked the people in the top 15th percentile and the bottom 15th percentile in terms of how lonely they rated on the test. And what they found was, when they compared these two very different groups of people, the people that were very lonely according to the test had really abnormal expression of some immunity genes. They had high expression of genes that cause inflammation and low expression of genes that would protect the body against microbes and viruses and other things. So this seems to be very strong evidence that loneliness not only makes you feel bad, but can actually make you physically feel bad by compromising your immune system and making you more subject to certain types of diseases, such as heart disease or dementia or even certain types of cancer.
So is there any way to turn this around and say, is there some sort of genetic basis to chronic loneliness?
Well, it's a good question. Now that they've got these sort of genetic markers, researchers are hoping that sometime in the future, doctors will be able to tell, maybe based on their genetic profile, which people are maybe more subjected, more vulnerable to these lonely-related diseases, and might be able to do some sort of proactive therapy that may not necessarily make them happier, but could make them healthier.
Well, David, a fascinating trio as always. Thanks very much for coming down.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the September 21st, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.